Well, let's turn in our Bibles tonight to the book of Daniel in the Old Testament, chapter 3. And we'll return to this chapter that we began last week. Famous chapter of the fiery furnace, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and the test that they were placed under as officials in Babylon, and the test of their faith, the test of their loyalty to God and their worship of God and their loyalty to his covenant and his law. And I'm going to read the beginning portion here. We're going to complete the chapter tonight, but I want to read the beginning so we have the context and remember where we were last week. Chapter 3, verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the province or the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image the king Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." And so here is the challenge, and here is the scene. Faithful believers in 580 BC, about that time frame, we can time this or place this, are being forced to make some hard choices about their lifestyle and the governing authorities that they sit under, the laws, the customs, the culture, the opinions and views that they're subject to as being exiled into Babylonian land. And they had to be wise, they had to be shrewd, but faithful and uncompromising in their morals. And the law has told them and taught them from their youth that you shall not bow down to or worship images and idols. You will have one God, one Lord. You shall worship him alone. And you shall not make anything in this earth of any carved image, anything by which is of the likeness of things in heaven or on earth, and bow down and worship them. They know this. And here they are put to the test in this idol world that they live in. Daniel and his friends are petitioned at other times to make some decisions, and they had to be wise. Earlier, it had to do with food, and they chose in petitioning to say, we're not going to eat the food given to us from the king's table, and the connection there probably is due to their association with idolatry, that food, where it came from, so they chose not to eat that and to eat what would be vegetables. And so they had to make some tough decisions. Later, Daniel would be challenged to continue to pray three times a day, which was to not deviate from his normal spiritual practice, to pray to the Lord. And he'd be challenged because there was a command that came down from the king not to pray to anybody or any god except to the king. And therefore, again, in this world that they're in the context that they're in, they are tested according to their faithfulness to God. In this chapter, we have these three friends. Their names are Hananiah, which means Yahweh is gracious, Mishael, which means who is like God, and Azariah, which means Yahweh has helped. They're known or given new names in the Babylonian world and their officialdom, and renamed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those names mean command of the moon god Aku, that's Shadrach. Who is what Aku is, that's Meshach, that's kind of a play on his other name, Mishael, which means who is like God. They just swung it around to an idol, who is like Aku. And then Abednego means servant of Nebo. So all of those names connected to, of course, the culture that they're in, the customs that are in, it's just infused with idolatry and the worship of the stars and the worship of these gods of the stars and all sorts of types of idols. So here they are, living in this. And now these three friends are put to the forefront. This will be their last appearance in the book, but here they are, young men, teenagers possibly, maybe a little older than that, maybe in their early 20s, and they are set before King Nebuchadnezzar to make their answer about their failure to bow down and worship this image. And he's made this golden image, probably from the previous chapter, having seen the dream that he was given by God and then was interpreted by Daniel. And the head of this particular image in the dream is a head of gold. And that was, he said, that's you, Nebuchadnezzar, and that's your kingdom, Babylon. And he's probably impressed by that and thought, well, I'm going to one-up this. I'll make my own image on this earth and have everybody worship that image. And he has them all bow down to this against their customs and culture. Whatever religious affiliation all these officials came from does not matter right now. You are to bow to my idol. You're to bow to my image. And probably was in the likeness, made in the likeness of Nebuchadnezzar, some have suggested. So clearly, here's this king who has not much respect for the God of Daniel and his friends. Now, he's acknowledged them. He's stated that in chapter 2, truly, in verse 47, your God is God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery because of Daniel's ability to tell him what the dream was and the interpretation. And therefore, he gives some acknowledgement to their God and kind of highly praises the God of these Jews as the God of gods. He's the chief of the gods. He would call them the God, the most high God of all the gods. But he's still a moon worshiper. He's still an idol worshiper. It's just another God. And so he builds this image. And out of his desire for honor and his desire for power and probably desire for loyalty amongst his officials, he forces them all to bow and give praise to his God or his own self, whatever this means. Here's this emboldened pride of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, why did Nebuchadnezzar do this? Probably because he wanted loyalty of his chief officials, and to prove it, there to do this. And he's probably got a big head out of this. So here's the three young men. And these are the three who don't. They remain standing, the rest are bowed down. And now they're faced with, and in doing this, the decision that we talked about, the idea of civil disobedience. Civil disobedience to the Christian and to the believer. When the state forbids you to do what the Lord commands you to do, you are now have to make this decision to disobey the state and obey God, and thus do it civilly. Or when the state commands us to do what the Lord forbids us to do, as is the case here. So the state is telling Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to bow down to this idol. They cannot do that. They must obey God first, and thus they must disobey King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, sometimes the state engages in unfair practices that aren't necessarily stated in Scripture. By doing these things or abiding by these or submitting to these, we're violating Scripture. For example, give to Caesar what is Caesar, paying taxes to Caesar, giving money to a brutal regime, a pagan, idolatrous government. Jesus said, you're to give that money. They're actively oppressing the Jews. It might not be fair, might not be pleasant, but give to Caesar what is Caesar's. So we have to make decisions in such circumstances. And here in our time and our age, as things begin to change and have been changing and culture's going in this direction and public opinion's going in that direction, and here we are, we're left behind, or suddenly we're now seen as the enemy or opposed to the way things are and what's right in the eyes of people today, we have to make decisions. And those decisions sometimes can have some pretty serious consequences. What's the consequence? For Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to not bow down? Death by fire immediately. So this is serious. This is massively serious for them. And for us, it might be thrown in jail or a fine or whatever for something. But it might go here because not too many years ago was the same type of sentence given to Christians in England. Just post right around the Reformation, when Mary, Queen of Scots, took the reign, she immediately went on a campaign to arrest all of the Reformed leaders, at least the preachers, and take them all and put them under lock and key and then have them executed. And the first to do that, the Hugh Latimers and Nicholas Ridleys and Hoopers and others, they were burned at the stake. Because of their Protestant faith. So they faced the fire. God did not come to their rescue. They died by fire. They had to make a decision. Recant and join with the Roman Catholic movement of Mary or die based on our loyalty to God and to the faith. And they died. And they died willingly, knowing that in that day they were heading straight to heaven upon their death. And as Hugh Latimer told, I believe it was Hugh Latimer told Ridley, be the man, Sir Nicholas Ridley, because we're going to light a flame that's going to change England as a result of our death. And they did. So there's some serious matters here to think about and consider for Christians in different places and different times that we're called to. And here these three are put in a place where they are to give testimony to the Lord and to defend the truth and not compromise. We talked last time, I gave a few things to think about. The time may come when you'll be forced to decide whether to disobey or compromise. And you've got to be the man or be the woman, whatever it may be, and stay faithful. Stay the course and disobey if need be. And the world may give cursory respect for our God, as Nebuchadnezzar did. Yes, your God, we respect your God and whatnot, but remember, this world is under a different prince. And the rulers are under the power of the prince of the air that is against Christ. And they will hate you, ultimately, as he hates you. They will, by nature, go in a direction that will oppose you. And we will have to face those types of consequences for being faithful. We have to keep that in mind. And so you have to ask the question, do you value your life more than you value your soul? and faithfulness to the Lord? Will you and are you willing to lay down your life for his name's sake and face persecution for his name's sake? Will you get in line with the others, as Hebrews 11 talks about those who gave their life because of their faith, gave their life at the hands of their own countrymen even? More than likely, the Lord may choose not to miraculously spare your life, as was the case of literally 200, 300 Christians in the time of Mary, Queen of Scots, also known as Bloody Mary. He chose not to spare their life, but they were a testimony of faithfulness. So the consequences are serious. The consequences of civil disobedience in Babylon is death by fire. They were summons to the court. Nebuchadnezzar was the one who puts them on trial, and he was in furious rage, it says there in verse 13. He orders that seven times here, because of their response, I'm going to heat it up and put the pressure on. They were questioned by the king. Is it true you won't serve my gods? The answer is obvious. No, we will not. They're given one last offer to recant. You can recant. You can bow right now. One more chance. More pressure. And they will not do it. And then they're challenged, is laid down by Nebuchadnezzar. He says, who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? And that answer is going to happen for the rest of this chapter. Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hand? Their defense is simple. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be known to you, O king, we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. And there is the line that they draw, and they're willing to die. So let's take a look now at verse 19. Here's the sentence. The sentence. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury. He's a very emotional individual, an emotional judge here, and a king. He takes great offense. He's taken this to heart. This is an insult to him and to his gods. This is a statement about his beliefs and his position as ruler over all that they're not respecting in his eyes, and they don't respect his beliefs, and they don't respect his gods, and they will not even acknowledge his gods other than we will not bow down and serve them as if they don't exist, because they don't. They're just things carved and made by the hand and skill of man. And so he is in a rage, and he's ready to bring down the sentence. It says he was filled with fury in verse 19, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We can assume there that he probably had a favorable disposition towards him back in chapter 1, learning about these three and Daniel, and how well educated they are, how skilled they are, great young men, far beyond advanced the others. These are going to be good sorts of individuals in my court and in my provinces as rulers. I could use them. But that has now changed, because now what they have done is they have stepped on my idol. They have knocked over my idol. They have offended my love. They have given disrespect and dishonor to that which I think should be respected and honored. That's intolerable. And now he is, in his facial expressions and in his internal heart, in full fury and ready to bring the hammer down on them. He ordered the furnace heated seven times more than it was usually heated. Put in seven times more fuel for the fire for these three. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. It was happened so quickly. Normally you would take their clothes from them and just cast them in. In this case, no, just tie them up and throw them in right now. And because the king's order was urgent, and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed these men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. There's the sentence. before all the watching eyes, the orders carried out in haste, and at the cost of the guards even. So the three Jews, by the way, should have perished at this point as well. If these mighty men who had thrown them in, and it was so hot that the fire and the heat had killed them at an instant, it should have killed the three young men. Truly, this is an unjust decree. It's an attack on the people of God. It's unreasonable and irrational, but he's the king. He's the king. It's unreasonable and rational indeed. Well, he made an image and told everybody to bow down to this, saying, this is now a God that you can worship, just making things up as you go. Now, to be fair, Nebuchadnezzar is just acting on his own nature. This is who he is. He's no believer in God. He is a moon worshiper and a sun worshiper and a self worshiper. He's a pagan, as any pagan would be. And as a king, he demands loyalty from his subjects, but especially his officials, and he has absolute authority and power to punish any who would defy that. So it's natural for him to respond like this and put people to death for not giving him what he thinks he deserves. Now, in a pagan world, that loyalty typically is wrapped up in idolatry and the worship, the false worship of idols. And where your fidelity to a god can change and morph and be assimilated into worship of all other types of gods, it made sense for these other pagans, yeah, we'll bow down to this god too, because there's a whole bunch of gods and your gods. We'll give respect to your god. I'll still worship my god, but we're all idol worshipers and gods are this, that, and the other, and it's not a big deal to a pagan world. That's the way Nebuchadnezzar would think. What's the big deal? And he's already acknowledged the existence of the Jewish God as the Most High God, and that these men are his servants, but he wants a good measure of glory for himself to share with God, and that's the way we are. That's the way the world is, stealing God's glory and wanting it for ourselves, wanting to share that, wanting to get into the light. So you've got this God here, but I don't respect him enough, and we want to share all things, and we want to take up some glory for ourselves, and you need to respond and respect me for this. The fact that they refused to bow down to his idol, though, caused such an emotional, fiery, offended response. But that's consistent with people who cling so tightly to their heart idols, that heart idolatry, the things that desire most, the things that they have security in, the things that they think is the most important thing. They'll do anything for that, and everybody else needs to respect that. Someone comes along and kicks dust on that, and up comes the fire and the fury. And for a king, I'll just put you to death. You've offended my God. There's the sentence. Now comes the deliverance, verse 24. And here's the great scene. Then King Nebuchadnezzar, verse 24, was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king. He answered and said, but I see four men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. So they're given this image here. And here's this scene. Thrown into the fire, and it's beyond belief at this point. There's a deliverance that happens here. It's an immediate deliverance. As soon as they reach the flames, the mighty men are consumed, and these three, I don't know, whatever was binding them just burned up, and they just start walking around in the middle of a seven times hotter, fiery furnace. This is crazy. Nebuchadnezzar looks, and his emotions are still amped up, only this time the anger towards them for not respecting his idol has now turned to surprise and shock at witnessing what has happened. And now his mind is spun around. What's going on here? How is this even possible? They're walking around in this hot furnace that I can't even get very close to as they're watching from a distance. Only he mentions this. I see four of them. I thought there was only three. How's there four? Who's that fourth? Now, you got to get yourself in the mind of this pagan, and he's seeing a fourth one, and he calls it one like a son of the gods. So it must be some type of angel, some type of race of the gods that has visited these three. So he must have come from or a part of this god they worship who's come to their aid. And so he's kind of getting a little bit of an idea of something miraculous and amazing has now taken place coming from their god. It is miraculous already, but here's this fourth person showing up into the picture. Now, he doesn't know the true Son of God or who could be appearing here in this pre-incarnate Christophany, if that's what it is, or a theophany, or the angel of the Lord. Here's this one like a son of the gods. Now, the Lord appears many times in the Old Testament. He's not aware of that, but these men are. They're very familiar of the angel of the Lord appearing to Joshua. They're very familiar with the Lord himself walking with angels and meeting with Abraham, and the angel of the Lord wrestling with Jacob. They're familiar with those things. So Nebuchadnezzar's not. So here's this another scene, only it's very interesting that it is revealed to these pagans at this time and to these Babylonians. Of course, we're in the time of exile. So here is where God is making his power known amongst pagan people. So the deliverance happens. They're delivered from the flame. They're not killed. And it's a miracle. Number three, the miracle. It's a miracle when natural science is suspended. That's what a miracle is. Not normal or natural or scientific for an overheated furnace to be unable to burn human flesh. And so they're walking about. Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace, and he declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the king's counselors gathered together this great throng of people and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of these men. The hair of their heads was not singed. Their cloaks were not harmed. No smell of fire had come upon them. There's the miracle. And this is not normal for this to happen. Okay? For God to deliver a person from execution like this, we don't see this every day, but here it is. And like I said, of the time of the English reformers and Mary and her bloody campaign, 288 persons were burned at the stake over the course of 4 years, 1555 to 1558. 288 persons. 56 of them were women, some children. At least one couple was burned alive with their daughter, all because of their Protestant faith, all because they professed the true gospel faith and not Catholicism. There's no recorded miracle of someone surviving the burning at the stake execution. That would be normal. That would be expected. For sure, these persons didn't die because they didn't have enough faith, by the way. To the contrary, they're all exhibiting great faith and hope in the Lord, and were well received into heaven as martyrs by God. That's examples of typically how things happen. Here is atypical. Here's a miracle, and they're wondering what has happened. They can't smell smoke on them. The hair on their bodies is not singed. When I'm barbecuing and I'm grilling, first thing that goes is the hair on my hands or whatever it is. It singes up, and that's just how it is, and that's just a lame heat compared to this. But here they are, and the evidence is before everybody's eyes to examine and look at. This is a miracle. We just witnessed a miracle. My sister-in-law, LaVon, you know her, was in a house fire many years ago in Georgia. The house didn't burn, but all the smoke got throughout the house, and everything smelled of smoke. For years afterwards, clothing and everything else, they just had to replace stuff. They couldn't get rid of the smoke. That's how it is. And here we smell Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's like, I thought we threw them in a fire. They don't smell at all. The Lord had preserved them and protected them. And the Lord was in the midst of the fire with them, I believe. So here they are. And he calls them servants of the Most High God. And notice Nebuchadnezzar still refers to them as servants of that God, and that he's the Most High God, kind of like the Greeks call Zeus, the Most High of the gods, the chief of all the gods of the pantheon. And that's what he's doing here. He's acknowledging that. There's a statement about the three, though, that is different than what he thought only moments before. They were antagonists to my gods. They're servants of the Most High God. And no God can rescue them out of my hands. Well, this one can. You're the servants of the Most High God. There's the answer to my challenge. Remember that challenge? Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Here he is. The Most High God of the Jews. It's a battle between the deities in the eyes of Nebuchadnezzar. And he is forced to acknowledge the truth of the existence of this God and the greatness and the power of this God to protect his people and to carry them through the fire, to rescue them out of the hands of their enemies. This is the testimony that Nebuchadnezzar learns. It's the same testimony that should have been learned by Israel on Mount Carmel with Elijah and the 850 prophets of Asherah and Baal. God made himself known there. Everyone should have learned the lesson real quickly. Here is the true God. He is the Lord. The Lord God, he is the Lord. That was the lesson that they should have learned, but that was a few generations before they were taken into exile for their idolatry, sadly enough. So what's the effect that this has on Nebuchadnezzar in the conclusion here? How does this affect him? Verse 28. So here he does the examination. He sees this miracle. He witnesses it. He calls them out. He examines them. They're not touched. Obviously, their God has preserved and delivered them and protected them from my hand. He's the mighty God over all gods. And here's his response. And by the way, when we look at verse 28, and he answers and says this, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and goes on with these words. The effect that this has on this pagan king is astounding. This is a pagan king. This is a moon-worshipping king. This is a king who thinks he's a god. This is a king who's used to being taught all the different religions of the world and not familiar with this here. And now he comes face to face with the true God. This should have been the same effect upon the kings of Judah and Israel, the ones that were unfaithful to God, the king Ahab of the north and Ahaz of Judah, who had not that type of response that Nebuchadnezzar has here. And by the way, they had far more evidence, far more proofs, far more miracles to judge reasonably and make a statement and decrees for the people of God and Israel that Nebuchadnezzar now makes. So think about that. Why is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Babylon? It's because of the people's unfaithfulness and failure to do what Nebuchadnezzar does right here. Watch what he does. First, he gives glory to the God of Israel. Glory. Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He sent his angel. He's acknowledging their God exists, and their God comes to the rescue of his servants and protects them. He cannot be overpowered. He overpowers me. He gives glory to that God. This is the second time he is forced to reasonably acknowledge this. The other time was, of course, when the dream was revealed. And he says, out of all the others who are not able to reveal the dream and this interpretation, Daniel gives it. And Daniel says, God gave me this. My God gave me this. Here's the dream. And he's forced to acknowledge, truly your God is the God of gods and Lord of lords. He's done that once, but he's not a convert at this point. Here's the second time around. He gives the same acknowledgement. Blessed be the God of these Jews here. And so there's glory given to him. And all he knows is this God has sent his angel to deliver his servants here. This fourth person in the fire who didn't come out, who is that one? He is from this God. He's tied to this God. That individual to Nebuchadnezzar's eyes is angelic and belonging to the realms of the gods, to his pagan eyes. So he gives glory to the God of Israel. Secondly, he gives glory to his goodness. His goodness, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants. Now, in the typical pagan world with their gods, the gods don't really have much care at all for the people. Goodness towards humanity and human flesh, they care about themselves. They care about their things in the God world. That's the pagan world. But this God cares about his servants. This God sent this angel to these people to deliver them. He's good. So he acknowledges that God has come to their rescue. Here's the God who can rescue them out of my hands. So there's the goodness and the glory of the God. Thirdly, he commends their loyalty to their God. So there's something of this loyalty. They're faithful and loyal to him. He comes to their aid and rescues them. There's certainly a relationship there tied between his people and their God. He says this, he delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. There's that loyalty. There's that trust. And he commends them for that. It wasn't but minutes before he is furious and enraged for that, thinking, who do you think you are? What type of arrogance do you have? You need to give your loyalty to me. And there is no God who can rescue you out of my hands. And now he's switched around and saying, there is a God, and you guys should be commended for trusting in him and not giving into my decree and not worshiping any other gods, but your God and your God alone. He commends them for that. Well, I wish the kings of Israel commended their people for being loyal to God rather than Baal and Asherah and the other gods. Certainly, Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego can look back at their history and their ancestors and their kinsmen and say, we're here because of their disloyalty to God. We're not going to follow in those footsteps. We will be faithful even unto death to our God. If all the nation of Israel had done as these three faithful Israelites did here, trusting, defying idolatry, faithfully adhering to their God and worshiping him only, faithful to the law, obeying God's law, then they would have been delivered out of his hand when Nebuchadnezzar invaded Judea. If they would have been like that, God would have delivered them from Nebuchadnezzar's hand. But they were not like that. They were unfaithful, and thus God gave them over to Nebuchadnezzar's hand. There's something of a lesson here to the Israelites as they read this and they see this example before their eyes. And it's a pagan king who's giving the commendation here. He's seeing the reality and the responsibility here, and this is reasonable to say this and to think this of these faithful ones and their God. Fourth, he then defends the honor of God's name. He goes further than that. It's not just words of commendation here. He then moves to make decrees. Watch this in verse 29. And again, think of Israel and Judea and Judah. Why couldn't their kings make decrees like this? Think about that. Why couldn't they make a decree what Nebuchadnezzar, this pagan moon worshiper, does? He says, therefore, I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. I mean, make some laws here to promote and protect the honor of this true God by which they worship. Let's make some rules to protect that and not tolerate those who are intolerant and attack and scoff this God. That's what he does. He lays it down there in Babylonian jurisprudence and law. Same threat given to those regarding the dream. I'll tear you limb from limb and your houses will be a dung heap if they do this. He's forbidding anybody from despising or reviling the Lord. I mean, why couldn't Israel do that? Why couldn't Ahaz and the others, those kings, have been making such proclamations to protect the honor and dignity of the God they worship and serve? And then number five here is he honors the servants of his God in verse 30. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. They were already officials. That's why they were called at this time with the other officials. It was only officials of the provinces who were called in here before the image to bow down to the image, show their loyalty to Nebuchadnezzar, worship the image. And so they're already in a position of officials, so now they're promoted higher, and they're given great honor here. This shows the regard the king has and great favor towards them to promote them for their faithfulness to God. There's no suspicion. There's no fear of them at this point. He's actually looking. These guys are pretty good. These guys have some integrity. These guys have some loyalty. These guys are faithful and can be trusted for what they say and what they do. I want them in high positions in my kingdom. That's a pretty smart idea for King Nebuchadnezzar to do. And the opposition from the Chaldeans that were malicious, that was squelched immediately with this pronouncement. We're not getting rid of them. We're actually promoting them now and putting them up. The godly are the ones the king should promote and trust and rely and honor. And so Nebuchadnezzar is actually a brilliant individual, even though he's irrational at times. He's brilliant and he's smart. He's making these decisions for the betterment of his kingdom. And he promotes these three individuals, saying, "You guys are the ones I want in my courts." So wise choices. In the book of Proverbs, we have these words to kings. Proverbs 25:5, "Take away the wicked from the presence of the king, and his throne will be established in righteousness." Put that on the other side. Put forth the righteous in the presence of the king, and again, the throne will be established in righteousness. It's wise to do this, what he's doing with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, rather than putting them to death. Or chapter 16, verse 12 and 13, Proverbs, "It's an abomination to kings to do evil, for the throne is established by righteousness. Righteous lips are the delight of a king. He loves him who speaks what is right." Now that was Solomon, and that was godly kings, and here we have a pagan king who is acknowledging as well. I prefer those who speak what is right, those who are loyal, those who are faithful, and who have a God, the God of gods, on their side, and they serve that God. We're putting them right here in the kingdom role, in the provinces. Now think about this as we conclude this chapter in the fiery furnace. What's the point of this chapter? What is this trying to say? I think there's a number of things here. Besides teaching the lesson to the Jews at this point and post-exile, which would be as they come back from the exile after Daniel is gone and moving on, they would read this, and this would be an encouragement to them to stay faithful. Don't compromise. Stay faithful, and God will be with you. God will preserve and protect. So there's some things here that need to be learned. And think about if these three had compromised. Let's say they just bowed their, just to kind of save their skin and went with the flow. A few things that would not have happened. First, God's glory would not have been promoted here. It would have been stolen, really, and given to the image. They had to, for the sake of the glory of God, remain standing, even if it cost them their life. And God used that to glorify his name through King Nebuchadnezzar. Think about that. You take some risks for the Lord. Watch what happens. Watch what he does with it. Also, the king would not have been given the opportunity to see and know the power of their God. And here he sees it again, and now he's, "You're the servants of the Most High God. Your God sent and delivered you and preserved you because you trusted in him. Therefore, I'm going to make a decree about that God now." So that's an opportunity that God is exalted and his power is revealed through them because they didn't bow. They didn't compromise. They would not have been able and been used by the means, as God uses means, to use to reveal himself to this Nebuchadnezzar and all the officials. Here's the means that he uses to reveal himself, to show himself true. The true God. So that compromise would have cost a lot here. But faithful and loyalty is what is the reward. It brings the rewards. So in conclusion, let's think about those things. In conclusion, what do we have to say and what can we draw from this? Well, let's start with this. In the New Testament, we are given the Great Commission. And in the Great Commission, we're told to go into the world. We're not going to be exiled into the world and forced in a place like Nebuchadnezzar, but we will be called in missionary activity to places like that. And then the Great Commission, we're given this promise. Behold, I have commanded you, and I am with you always to the end of the age. The fourth one in that fire, whether it was an angel of the Lord or a Christophany, a theophany, probably, that's true. Wherever we are in the Great Commission, we understand this, that he is always with us. He does not abandon us. He's with us in the task. So we can be faithful and should be faithful, and he'll use these things for his glory. So think in those terms. Secondly, there will be tensions between obeying God and obeying human authorities. You're always going to be tested there. Trust in the Lord, stay true to his word. It's simple. Trust in the Lord, stay true to his word, maintain your integrity. You will be tested, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in your family, amongst those who are non-believers or whatever. Some type of tests can be thrown your way that's going to challenge whether you're going to compromise truth, you're going to compromise honesty, you're going to compromise on morality. Whatever it is, it's always going to be there, and our task is to stay faithful. Follow in the footsteps of these three men. Third, human powers, human authorities are always temporary and temporal. Nebuchadnezzar's in charge at that moment, but he would be gone. God will remain, and God's people will remain. We must maintain our faith and moral integrity in season and out of season. Don't rest and wait for governments to change. Just stay faithful to God. He's in charge of those things in season and out of season. In season, when things go well for us. Out of season, when we're the enemy, when we're looked down and we're opposed. Fourth, God will look after those who trust in him, either rescuing them from danger or bringing them home to heaven. One way or the other, he will not forsake us in that. He will not forsake us. Remember these words from Paul to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 4, 16, 17, and 18. He says, "At my first defense, no one came to stand by me, but all deserted me." So here's Paul in prison in Rome, brought before probably Nero or some type of court proceeding for his life. No one was there to defend him. All deserted him. No friends, no help. May it not be charged, he says, against them. But the Lord stood by me and strengthened me, so that through me the message might be fully proclaimed and all the Gentiles might hear it. So I was rescued from the lion's mouth. Now, I don't know specifically what he's talking about there exactly in the historical sense. What was that deliverance? How did the Lord stand by him and strengthen him during that time so that the gospel was proclaimed? How was he spared from the lion's mouth? Is that literal? Possibly. But the simple fact is this: the Lord did not forsake him. Everyone else did, the Lord did not. That will always be the case for you believers. In Hebrews chapter 11, remember these faithful ones. Their faith, through faith, conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions. Oh, now we're in Daniel's territory here. Quenched the power of fire. There's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, become mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two. They were killed with the sword. They were about or went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy. Love that comment. Wandering about in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. And all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us they should not be made perfect. They'll all be part of what is this communion of faith and the people of God joining together, and so many testimonies of those having to go through severe treatment and those who are rescued miraculously. And it would be a wonderful grand party to hear the stories and to see them all relay them in God's presence. God will not forsake us. He will not forsake us. We stay faithful to Him. Now, God at times reveals His power that even the heathen rulers will be constrained to recognize Him and give Him glory. Sometimes they act more sensibly when given this knowledge than those who know better. Nebuchadnezzar acted much more sensibly than Ahab. Much more sensibly. We know better. We know the Lord is with us. We know that we must live morally before His eyes, not compromise to save our own skin. We know that we may be the ones that the Lord uses to open other people's eyes, to see the light of the glory of God through us. We have to be faithful in our words and in our actions so that God would use that for that purpose. These three Jews were used by God to open Nebuchadnezzar's eyes and come to know this Most High God, which is the very next chapter. As we're moving and progressing through this king's life, eventually he is at the point where this is the only God, and this is the one I believe, and all the others I forsake. We'll see that when we get there next time in chapter 4. Let's pray. Lord, I do thank You for these trials, these tests, these powerful scenes of history that proved to be an example and an opportunity to give glory and praise and honor to Your name and Your power. And may we be used in that way, maybe in simple things, in simple experiences at the workplace where we are tested and we are tempted to compromise, that we might be faithful in that time at risk of losing our job or losing that promotion or losing that respect. But You will use that faithfulness. We know You will, for Your glory. May we understand that where we play in this, what part we play in the whole scheme of Your purposes to reveal Yourself to others, that they might bow the knee no longer to their idols, but to You and You alone. Use us for that purpose, Lord. We're thankful for this story, thankful for the truth of it, thankful for Your testimony of Your faithfulness and your godly servants who are examples to us. And may You bless our hearts to be strengthened to follow in their footsteps. Thank You as we pray this in Christ's name. Amen.